Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I am joined by my friend Steve Ray, who is a friend of Ave Maria Radio and this program, and he is a prolific author and pilgrimage leader, and he's joining us to give us an illustrative description of those events and persons and places that take place throughout Holy Week, because these were real people. These are historical events, and this will greatly help our meditation. Steve, thank you so much for being here. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing well, thank you. And not only are they real things, but they took place in a real place. I mean, right. Real land and real... Right. And to understand the land and the people and the culture and the history, it takes a great imagination to put yourself back in there. I don't know that anybody's done it better than Mel Gibson in his movie, The Passion of the Christ. But to put you have to think of yourself in the Jewish context and the whole 2,000 years ago, the Roman context. Yeah. And it's because there's a lot. And you know, our disadvantage today is we got roughly 30 minutes if you take in with the breaks and everything. And we got to cover 4 days in 30 minutes. That's less than 6-7 minutes a day.
That's
of the most profound things that ever happened on the face of the earth.
Exactly. Quite literally, Pope Benedict the 16th calls the Paschal Mysteries the pivotal event that changed human history.
Yeah, to where space and time and eternity and all intersected in one place. You know, it's and here we are supposed to talk about this in 30 minutes and cover all of this. I quit. I can't do it.
Well, no, we're going to have to.
Okay.
And
We'll do it.
Jesus and his apostles go into this upper room and they have a casual meal and they chit-chat. That's basically what happened on Holy Thursday.
Yep.
Except it really wasn't.
Yeah, I've seen that happen. I went to the Oberammergau plays when they were a couple of years ago. We went, and it was so sad because it was once really a Catholic, the Oberammergau Passion play for 500 years, I think it was. And they reduced it now. They said that they had to bring it to modernize it to a modern age. And Jesus held up a piece of bread and he said, "Here, eat this and remember me." Mm. And that was the Last Supper. And it was really sad. I was very disappointed in the whole thing. But anyway, the real thing is very, very cool and very exciting. It's a cosmic adventure. This is really a cosmic battle and a cosmic adventure. We don't even see all the things going on behind the scenes with the devil and the evil spirits and the angels and the power of God and all this is happening. This is just this most swirling drama that it could ever be a part of. And so many people have tried to put it on in artwork, the cross, and in plays and movies, and it just never quite gets there, you know, because how can you encompass all the reality of what happened that week?
And Mel Gibson's movie does a tremendous amount of good, but even that pales in comparison to the richness of the gospel narrative. So tell us, we've got very little time, but we need to cover just how many monumental things Jesus achieved in that upper room.
I like to call this the virtual tour of the Passion of Christ. And when we have time, we do it then and now, what it was like then and what it's like if you go there now. We won't have much time for the now part. But the upper room is, he said, "I have longed for this night." So it's not just that he went up there for a meal or it was that yearly Passover meal, but he actually says in Luke 22, "I've earnestly desired to eat this with you." Why would he earnestly desire? Because he's changing what has been for 3,500 years or even more, but the Passover meal, which is a remembering of the lamb dying and the blood on the doorposts and lentils and the eating of the meat of the lamb. But he's changing that now. Actually, he's not just changing the Passover meal. He's taking all of the sacrifices of the Old Testament and he's consolidating them all into one sacrifice on the cross, and you can't separate the cross from the Eucharist. They're one and the same.
That's right.
It's the same thing. When you are at the cross, this is the Eucharist, and at the altar, this is it being represented in a real way. And this is a nuptial meal, and this is why he said this. There's so many reasons he even said, "This is my body," because he's the lamb. There's no lamb or priest in the upper room.
Yes.
There's supposed to be a lamb and a priest, and there's neither a lamb. Oh, wait a minute. There is a priest, isn't there? It's Jesus. And there's a lamb.
Yep.
It's Jesus. And what do you have to do in Book of Exodus? What did you have to do with the lamb before you got up and left? You had to eat the meat of the lamb. So Jesus said, this is my body. It's time to eat my flesh and drink my blood because I am the lamb up here. I am the Passover lamb. I'm the sacrifice. So eat my body. This is my body. I can imagine myself, Steve Ray the Baptist back then saying, Jesus, I think you made a mistake. I think you should say that this represents my body because we can all see it's a piece of bread. And there's going to be a billion Catholics someday that think you really meant what you just said, that it's your body. But that's exactly what he said.
Yeah.
And can you imagine me telling him he said it wrong? He said, I've longed for this, earnestly desired to say. Why? Because he's giving his body to us. And this is a nuptial meal. This is like like a marriage, a covenant. I know you love covenants. But this is really where the groom is giving his body to the bride.
Yeah.
Body, blood, soul, and divinity. The bride receives him into herself. Like a marriage consummation, and then they're unified and they're made one. This is what's happening in the upper room. I don't think the disciples knew all the depth of it, but they did know that this was a culmination of all of the feasts of the Old Testament, all of the sacrifices, the bulls, the lambs, the bread, all of them are now being culminated into one. And even the rabbi said that when the Messiah comes, there will only be one sacrifice left, the Thanksgiving sacrifice.
Exactly,
and that's Eucharist means Thanksgiving.
Yep.
So anyways, that's all what's going on in the upper room. And how in the world can you, I mean, I give a whole hour talk just on that.
Just on that, I know.
Because it's so rich.
I mean, even you started touching on the words, this is, you could do an hour talk on just, this is my body.
Yeah.
But we do have to move on because
This is on this Thursday. And I mean, there's so much happening still on Thursday.
So they walk out of the room
and
they're walking towards the Garden of Gethsemane.
Yes. Now, if you know, this is what I mean about the imagination, knowing the land and knowing what they're walking past. Because even when Jesus said at the end of chapter 14, let us get up and go from this place. That's what Moses said when they got up and left to go across the Red Sea.
Yeah.
He said, let us get up and go from this place. They had the staff. They just ate the meat of the lamb and are ready to go. That's what these guys did. Now, they're walking. Where are they walking? Well, first of all, they have to walk on the way from the upper room. They have to go down the Roman road. They have to go through and they go past the temple. And what does Jesus do at the temple? He prays the high priestly prayer, John 17. Where does the high priest pray the high priestly prayer? At the temple.
Yep.
He has to walk past the temple, and he stops, and he prays for all of us. He prays for three things. Number one, he prays for himself, the sacrifice and the priest. He prays for those 12 who are going to be his apostles, and he prays that they're consecrated. And then he prays for me, and he prays for you.
Yep.
And he said, it says, and he prayed for all of those to consecrate, all those who would believe through their word. And being God, he had every single one of us in his mind. If you don't think you're important to God, at that moment, on his way to Gethsemane, he was thinking about you and he prayed for you because he prayed for all those who would believe through their word. And he, being God, had every single one of us in his mind individually.
You know, his apostles watching this happen. You know, he literally stops in his tracks to do this.
Yes, and also the temple with John 15. What's that about? Vine and branches?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what is the temple? The temple, according to Josephus, had huge clusters of golden grapes hanging off the size of a man, clusters of grapes. Where are you going to talk about being the vine and the branches and bearing fruit? Then there's in the temple. He's standing right in front of that temple, and you're looking at all of that. And what did he say earlier? That my body is the new temple, and if you abide in me, you'll bear fruit. Look at this. This is the old temple. This is, we're going to do a new temple now, guys. And he keeps on walking. But just if you look at chapters 15, 16, 17, as to where he's standing, where he's walking, everything he says applies to the geography of the place. Then chapter 18 says, and he crossed into the Kidron Valley, which is the valley between the Temple Mount. And by the way, the Temple Mount that Herod had built was 30 football fields in size.
Yeah.
So that piece of flat that he had built, this flat platform to build a temple on, that was 30 football fields. Now it says he passed through the Kidron Valley and entered a garden. Now we get to Gethsemane, which means oil press. And believe me, that's where he was squeezed and he was pressed there. And the interesting thing is that he stepped into a garden.
Yeah.
And we'll have to come back to say, why not something else? Why a garden? Because it takes us back to Genesis.
You know, there are a few times where these breaks come at very painful moments. This is definitely one of them. Well, I guess it's Steve Ray, and we're talking about an illustrative description of the narrative of Holy Week. And we just started on Holy Thursday, so stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter. Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. We are talking with my friend Steve Ray, who is a prolific author, pilgrimage leader, lover of the scriptures. And Steve is giving us a descriptive and illustrative walk through the narratives of the scriptures from Holy Thursday all the way till Easter Sunday. So we just stopped in front of the temple. Like, we haven't made a lot of progress. We just stopped in front of the temple.
I know. Well, we now cross through the Kidron Valley, and we've gone into a garden called the Garden of Gethsemane, which means the oil press. And when you're reading the scriptures, you have to say, why does it tell about a garden? But also you have to remember that when John, the Gospel of John, says that the Calvary, the tomb, and the cross were also in a garden. And by the way, they just did archaeological discoveries that underneath the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, there is a garden. They actually found olives and grapevines and things under there, the seeds. So that just confirms that what John said is true. But it has to take place in a garden because Jesus is the new Adam, and he's coming to rewind. It's like a video. He's rewinding this video, and he's recapitulating. He's starting it over. The first Adam was in a garden at the tree of life and brought about death. The new Adam, he goes into another garden at the tree of death, and he brings about life. He has to do it in a garden.
Yeah.
They want you to know that it's in a garden so that you think garden, so that you can make the connection. So Jesus is now going into a garden. And I say that when I have my groups there, about a half an hour we do just to talk there, I say that this is probably the most painful part of Passion Week. We don't think that way. He's just in the garden. He starts to sweat. By the way, we have Mass at the rock where the blood dripped. And it's just, you know, people cry during that Mass because they're knowing he was there and his blood was dripping on this rock that we're all around during this Mass. And this was the most painful part of the Passion because I'm convinced that it's here that the sins of the world fell on him. And you know, he had a merciful crucifixion, Marcus. It was really, his crucifixion was somewhat merciful because he's only on the cross for 3 hours.
Yeah.
And there's records of the Romans keeping men alive on the cross for over a week.
Yep.
Just hanging there naked. I've got an article coming out in Catholic Answers magazine on Friday on was Jesus naked on the cross, because we have him covered, and rightfully so, but the reality was he wasn't covered when he was there. And to be hanging on a cross for a man for a week, like a billboard in front of the city gates, that would just be horrendous. You know? But Jesus only 3 hours. I think the real agony for him was in the garden, the church of the agony, because the sins of the world fell on him, and he who knew no sin became sin for us. He's never called he's never called love, 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 or justice, 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 but he is called holy, holy,
yes,
holy, which means a total separation from sin. And now he took all of your sins and my sins and the sins of the billions of humans. He took it all into his body like the scapegoat where all the sins are preyed onto them. He didn't become a sinner. He became a sin bearer, and
yeah.
I think that was psychologically, spiritually, emotionally the most agonizing part of the whole event. From that moment on, he felt, my God, why have you forsaken me? And his humanity, he felt that alienation because of his sin. And then we read in John 3:16, which I think is the most important verse in the Bible, for God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten Son, whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. John 3:16, as Baptists and Pentecostals, you had to cite the reference.
Absolutely.
But it, 2 verses before that, it says, as Moses raised up the serpent in the wilderness, so will the Son of Man be raised up. Well, wait a minute. Why is it that Jesus, an image of a snake? Shouldn't he be the lamb? Shouldn't you raise a lamb up, the innocent, pure lamb? But it says a serpent is a picture of Christ on the cross. Why? Because at that moment, he became the serpent in a sense. Yeah. He took all the sting of the devil into him. He became all of that poison went into him. And in a way, he took the devil himself up to the cross and he killed him and killed death and sin and destroyed the works of the devil on the cross. So that's why it's an image of the serpent on the cross, because he's picturing everything that's evil and he's taking it to the cross to destroy it. So that's just a little bit about Gethsemane. We could go on and on about Gethsemane, but that's...
I mean, you asked certain questions, like, where's Judas? Let's go from this place. You've already talked about the prayer at the temple.
Yep. And so then now he's arrested. Judas comes and he kisses him, and there's a whole lot to be said about that. We don't have time. And they come with torches, and they arrest him. And, you know, interesting, they carried swords back in those days. We don't think about that. And even the reading at Mass on Sunday, on Palm Sunday, Jesus said, "Do you have enough swords?" And they said, "We have two." He said, "That should be enough." I mean, they carried swords back in there for self-defense and so on. So Peter cuts the ear off of the servant Jesus. Can you imagine? You're coming to arrest this guy, and one of your guys cuts his ear off, and then Jesus puts it back on and heals it. I think I would say, you know what? I'm not messing with this guy.
That's right. Forget what we came here to do.
And he said, "Who do you look for?" Jesus. He said, "I am." He uses the ergo ami. That's the name of God from the book of Exodus. And when he said the name I am, they all fell over backwards. Yep. And by the way, it says that a cohort came. And a cohort is 600 men. Now, it doesn't mean that every single one of them got woke up in the middle of the night to go get Jesus. But the cohort is a Roman 600 men in a Roman army. So then they arrest him, and they take him now back across the same way that he just walked, back past the temple. And he has to go back through the city of Jerusalem, past the temple again, say up the same road that we go on when we go on our pilgrimage there. It's called the Roman Road. It steps all the way up to Caiaphas's house now, right next door to the upper room. But now we're in Caiaphas's house, and that's where he's tried, and they arrest him. And the Sadducees, but this is where you see how political this was. The crucifixion of Jesus really was a political event because they said, if we let this guy continue to do what he's doing, it's going to cause chaos. And this is Pentecost. This is a Passover and Pentecost. The Romans, Pilate didn't stay in Jerusalem. Why would you want to stay in Jerusalem? He stayed out on Caesarea on the Mediterranean Sea. It was like a beautiful capital city on the water. But during Passover, he had to come in because Jerusalem would swell to 2 million people because the Jews were coming all to go to Passover. And so he had to be there, and they had towers above the temple, and they could close two doors and shut it all down and stop, because if there's going to be an insurrection or problem, it's going to happen on Passover in that place, and it could be shut two doors, and they'd have them all trapped in there. And they had towers, four towers up in the Antonia Fortress. They could look down and watch, and Pilate's up there, and they're watching. And so it was a political thing. If there was going to be an insurrection, it would happen there. Jesus seems to be a radical who's saying you don't have to pay taxes. You don't have to follow the Mosaic law. Should we pay taxes? It's kind of like cavalier about it. Caesar. It's not my business. But the fact is that they said, if we let this guy continue to go on like he's going with all these people following him, Rome is going to come and they're going to take our place away from us. Mm-hmm. They're going to put an end. See, the Jews had special freedoms because of their
religious.
It was a political arrangement that they made with the Sadducees. The Sadducees were terrified. We got to get rid of this guy, because if not, Rome is going to come and take our place away from us, and we're going to lose all of our political clout that we have here. Well, anyway, there's a cistern under that where Jesus was kept in prison over Holy Thursday night. And people, how do you know that? Well, he had to be kept somewhere. They didn't put him up in the Hilton Hotel, that's for sure. And so there is underneath that, it's Caiaphas's house, a first century cistern, which is dug in the rock. The only way to get in is a hole in the top. They have a picture on the church there on the outside, a mosaic of Jesus with ropes all around him hanging, suspended into that cistern. And if you want to get an idea what it's like on Holy Thursday, read Psalm 88. The walls closing upon me. Yeah. I'm in a pit of darkness. It just is terrifying to read that. And I turn off the lights down there and I read that to everyone. I said, "Will any of you think of Holy Thursday the same again?" And they all say no, with tears in their eyes, "Never again." Jesus could have called 72,000 angels. That's 12 legion, and he could have, and they would have hit. They would have vaporized the Roman army, but he didn't. He went through with it, knowing what's going to happen. He's down in that water, cold. He's already bloody and beat up from the trial. Well, anyway, they pull him out of there early in the morning. The Romans were smart. They did things in the morning before it got too hot. And they even today, things close down from 12 to 3 or so when it's hot. So they get up early in the morning and they take him over to Pilate. And then we begin the trial of Pilate. So we're making progress.
We're making some progress. I don't want this to stop right now, but we do have to. We're talking with Steve Ray, who's walking us through events, places, locations, and persons in the Paschal narrative. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter. Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm talking with Steve Ray, who's giving us a descriptive illustration of the narratives of the Easter Triduum. And so, Steve, let's pick up exactly where we left off.
Okay. Now he's in front of Pilate early in the morning. Pilate wants nothing to do with this, and there's a lot we could say, but I'm just one of the points I think is very interesting is that when you brought the lambs for the sacrifice of Passover, you had to take them to the priest. They had to be certified as being blameless, spotless, without blemish. You couldn't bring the one with the mange or with his leg chewed off by the wolf or something. It had to be perfect. At the same time that the priests are certifying the lambs that are blameless, without blemish for sacrifice, just a stone's throw away, Pilate says of Jesus, "I find no fault in him, the true Passover lamb." At the same moment, the other lambs are being certified. Pilate says, "I find no fault in him. Take him away for the sacrifice." Well, this is really unusual. We know about the scourging, the mocking, the thorns, and there was no OSHA requirements or manufacturing specifications for how to make a whip. These guys would just sit around in the evening and they would make as cruel a whips as they could around the fires, joking and drinking their cheap wine, the soldiers, and they'd say, "Look at this piece of iron. I haven't put that in mine. Boy, it's going to get him tomorrow." And they did. And these guys were not Roman soldiers. They were conscripts from Syria and Egypt. The centurions and leaders were Romans, but they conscripted the local people. And those were the perennial enemies of Israel, Syria, and Egypt, and other places like that. They were the enemies of Israel. So when they said, "This is the king of Israel," they said, "Oh, man, are we going to have fun with this guy?" That's why they put the purple robe and the crown. They didn't do that to everybody, but they had the king of the Jews, our perennial enemy. We're going to take it out on him. Well, so then he goes through the Via Dolorosa. I give a whole talk just on the Via Dolorosa. But one story I like to tell is that there was one guy along the way that was the unluckiest and yet the luckiest guy ever, and his name was Simon the Cyrene. He was unlucky because he's not even from there. He's from Cyrene, which is in northern Africa. He's just there for the Passover. I just kind of funny saying, well, he was probably there in his new three-piece suit with his briefcase there on a business meeting, and all of a sudden they say, "Come on, you're going to help this guy." He says, "I just got this new suit. I don't want to get blood and guts all over my... Get over here and help him," you know. But he got so close, the blood touched him. And we know that he became a Christian because he had two sons named Rufus and Alexander, and they were known. The Gospel of Mark talks about them. And they became well-known leaders in the church because their father's experience with Jesus and the blood of Christ and he carried the cross physically. Jesus, "Unless you carry my cross," he actually did it. And because of that, it affected his whole family. That's why I said he was the unluckiest and yet the luckiest guy ever to get chosen to do that job. But they get there, and I love the scene where in Mel Gibson's movie where they're ripping the clothes off of Jesus. Imagine, his back is all bloody and raw, and they put the robes back on him, and you know when you get a wound, the blood, it heals, and it congeals, and it gets dried, and it sticks to everything. Like if my mom used to put a Band-Aid on me, and I'd say, "Okay, well, rip it off, put a new one on." Ouch, you know, because it dries on there. Jesus has now got this robe on, carrying the cross. They get there, they rip that robe off of him. All those wounds are reopened. And Mel Gibson flashes back to the upper room where Jesus has the basket with the bread, and he said, "This is my body," and he takes the cloth off the bread. And that's a picture of them taking the robe right. off of his body at the cross. It's just the correlation between he understood the Eucharist and the Passion of Christ at the cross are one and the same. They're the same thing. Well, anyway, so there's a whole thing about the Persians invented this 600 BC. It's the most horrendous way to die. The nails, they knew right where to put them, right through the median nerve, which is the most painful nerve, both in the feet and in the hand, right about the lower part of the wrist, yeah. because that's where the nails would go. It would hold the weight. If you put your fingers in the palm, it would tear right through. But this is still the palm. And in the Shroud of Turin, it shows it like at the base. It's still in the palm, but it's at the lower part goes up. And during World War II, morphine would not cut the pain of the median nerve because it was so painful. And yet Jesus is hanging there. Seven short words on the cross. "Mother, your son, your mother, I thirst." Why? Because the way you could kill a man on a cross is to give him no way to raise up. If he was just hanging by his arms, his diaphragm doesn't work.
That's right.
And he can't breathe and he'll suffocate. But if you put his feet up and nails in his feet, then he can raise up on those nails on his feet and he can take that pressure off his arms long enough, catch a breath. And then it hurts so bad, he goes back down and he can't. And then he has to go back up because he can't breathe. And he's "I thirst, mother, your son." He cares about his mom and John. And even while he's there suffering, and he talks to the guy at the cross. Both of those thieves were bad. They both were ridiculing Christ at first, but one had all of a sudden saw something. And Jesus didn't say, "Accept Jesus as your personal Lord and Savior and ask him to come into your heart." He didn't tell, "I'm going to lead you in the sinner's prayer." You know, didn't do that. There's a lot going on there. And he deals with that guy on his right where he's at with the short words that he can express. Well, he's only on the cross for 3 hours, but I like to say that even nature rebelled against this because nature sees their creator being killed. He became part of creation, and the sun is blocked. The rocks crack. I think nature just rebelled against this. Yeah. It reacted against it, and it was so powerful it said that corpses came up out of tombs. "Grandma, we just buried her 3 years ago. That's look at right. Grandma's... Grandma, what are you doing here? We buried you." But it says that the bodies came out of the tombs and were walking around. Because
right.
I think the power of that cross and what happened in the cosmic world with Satan and evil and all the things that we can't even begin to comprehend. I think they're going to come out in Mel Gibson's movie, though, in the resurrection. I think we're going to see that. Because I think those days after Jesus it says that he went down into hell. That's not the hell of the damned. It's not Gehenna. It's what's called Hades, the place of the dead, where they were waiting before they had to wait there, Abraham and the others, waiting for Jesus to defeat death, and then he could take them back with him up into glory. Now he's ready to take them. But it says in Colossians 2:15 that he led them in a victory procession, humiliated them. And that's a picture of the Roman Empire. When the Roman soldiers went and conquered a land, they would bring the king and all of his armies and all of his dignitaries, and they would have them in chains, and they'd make them crawl in front of the king or the emperor in Rome. They'd bring them to Rome, and they'd have what's called a victory procession. And they even have arches, Titus's arch, and they would bring them, and they just drag these guys, and they'd have to bow and scrape. They're all beat up and dirty from the journey, and they have to bow before the emperor of Rome and admit defeat. This is what happened. I think this is what Mel Gibson's going to do in his movie, The Resurrection. He's going to show that during that time, Jesus led those demons and evil spirits and devil right before the throne of God and made them grovel in front of God's throne and admit defeat.
Mm-hmm.
Because it says that in Colossians 2:15 that he led them all in a victory procession and humiliated them before God, that evil powers. So I can't wait for his movie. I think it's going to be a pretty awesome movie. Well, anyway, when he's on the cross, There's so much to say there, but it's the typology of Abraham and Isaac. I love to do this in my book on Genesis that just came out last year. I spend a whole chapter just discussing this. Abraham has to go to Mount Moriah. He's the father with his only beloved son, his only begotten son, and he has to take him to Mount Moriah and offer him a sacrifice. Why Mount Moriah? Because that's the top of Jerusalem. And 2,000 years later, another father with his only begotten son is going to take him to the same mountain and offer him as a sacrifice. Isaac carried the wood of the sacrifice on his back to the sacrifice. Jesus carried the wood of the sacrifice. When Abraham was there, he found the ram with his head stuck in a thorn bush. Jesus went up there with his head stuck in a thorn bush. Yeah. It's all the story of Abraham and Isaac is a picture. And not only that, but Isaac had to be at least 15 years or more old because he carried all of this and he understood what was going on. He walked 3 days. And there's no way. When I made my movie on Abraham, we actually built a big altar and I had a ram. I bought a ram to do this. I didn't kill the ram, but you think I did. And it took five of us to get that ram up on that altar. That was a big one with horns, and it took five guys to get that ram up there, and he was fighting us. And there's no way old Abraham could have got Isaac up on that altar by himself. Isaac had to be a willing sacrifice, just like Jesus went willingly also to the cross. Well, there's all that symbolism and typology of the gardens. In the Garden of Eden, Adam doesn't have a bride, so God puts him to sleep in a garden, cuts open his side, takes part of his body out, fashions a bride. Adam woke up and said, "Oh, she's beautiful. Look at this." He even writes a poem about it. And now we're in a new garden, and God the Father puts his son to sleep in a garden, cuts open his side with a lance, takes the blood and water out of it, fashions it into the bride. That's baptism and Eucharist. Fashions a bride out of what's in. He wakes up and he sees his bride on the day of Pentecost and he says, "Oh, she's beautiful." So if you don't think you're beautiful in love, just remember that you're the bride. That just like Adam got up and sang a poem to his new bride, Jesus is that way about you. Every single one of us, he loves us that much. Well, he's buried in a tomb with a rich man, Joseph of Arimathea. Remember that he was born in a cave provided by a man named Joseph. He's now buried in a cave provided by a man named Joseph. His mother wrapped him in the swaddling clothes, and I'm convinced that she wrapped him in the shroud. So you've got all these beautiful parallels. And he's buried there for those 3 days. It's not three full days. I have a blog on my blog coming up on Thursday, I think, or Friday, about how long was Jesus on the cross and how long was Jesus in the tomb, two separate ones. Because it says 3 days and three nights, but it wasn't. He went in there Friday afternoon when the sun was going down, and he was already up by Sunday morning when the sun came up. But that was a Hebraism, which is figures of speech, which we don't understand in English. Yeah. And that, but anyway, he's buried, and he rose from the dead, and the whole beauty. If you want to live this out, go to the Easter Vigil. And you will live this whole story out in the Mass because we have it presented to us.
My guest has been Steve Ray. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.